Thank you very much for joining us today, James, to talk about the University of Manchester's arguably most famous heritage hero, Alan Turing. So by the time Turing arrived in Manchester, he'd already cracked the enigma, potentially saving millions of lives and bringing the war to an end. But what was it that drew him to our mathematics department, do you think?
Very simple answer to that one. Access to a working computer. Because it's something a lot of people don't expect. Turing can actually designed a computer, which was supposed to be being developed at another site, the National Physical Laboratory in Greater London. That project was not going at all well. People there didn't like his designs. There was friction. It got rather bogged down. He actually, around that point, having come up with a full-scale design for a computer, which was eventually built in a slimmed down form after he left the project, he kind of got bored with designing computers. He got much more interested in the question, if you already had a computer, what could you use it for? And that's why he came to Manchester, because there were only two other computer projects in the country at the time. One in Cambridge, which was pretty well advanced, and Cambridge, you know, he knew Cambridge well, he'd been in Cambridge for years, it was a bit of a natural home for him, but he didn't get on well with the head of that project, Maurice Wilkes. So the only alternative, if he wanted a computer that he could play with, that he could use and try to get interesting outcomes from, the only alternative was Manchester, where Max Newman, who was a mathematician who had worked with Turing for a long time, he'd taught Turing. He was a bit older than Turing, so he'd taught him in Cambridge. And Newman had also been at Bletchley Park. He designed the big Colossus machines towards the end of the war, so the big, powerful electronic computers that were built after Turing had left. And so he was somebody who Turing got on with well. And Newman basically decided that it would be a very good idea if Turing was invited to work at Manchester. And Turing was happy to come along.
Okay, so he obviously had a little bit of an ulterior motive for coming, but what impact did Turing have on the mathematics department here?
Not very much, to be honest.
Okay, right.
This is an interesting one. Departments, universities, of course, were much smaller in those days. They were smaller physically, so people from different subject areas bumped into each other all the time. Laboratories were much smaller. You could walk around the whole of the university in the space of 5 minutes. So rigid departmental culture didn't really exist. Turing spent his time talking to a whole bunch of different people. So he was officially, he was a mathematician. The mathematicians were originally, they were housed together in the old main building, what's now the John Owens building of the university. Later on, he spent most of his time when he was on campus working with the computer, which was in a separate building, which had been built for the electrical engineers who'd ended up pretty much in charge of that project. But he talked to all sorts of other people. Later on, his last project was about mathematical biology. So he talked to the biologists. There was a botanist called Claude Wardlaw who he hung out with. He wasn't that involved, certainly on the teaching side, and he wasn't really involved in the life of the maths group. In fact, if you ask me about Turing's mathematical career outside of computers, I don't know very much about it.
Okay.
I mean, he did write a bit. He published a paper on Lie groups, if any mathematicians are listening. But he is best known for the stuff that he did in what became a whole bunch of other areas. Of course, he wasn't a computer scientist because computer science as a field hadn't been invented yet. It's kind of hard to get a field going when there are only three working computers in your country. But later on, that's what he was understood as having been.
So within a very short time of arriving in Manchester, he was named the deputy director of the computing machine laboratory. And I think we know why that is now. Can you tell me a little bit about the role that he played working on the Manchester Mark I?
Right. Now, the names are complicated. You don't need to worry about them too much. The Manchester Mark I had already pretty much been built at the time that he arrived. So the original idea was that Max Newman, his mathematician friend, was going to be in charge of computer development. The electrical engineers at Manchester had pretty much seized control of the agenda and built a computer on their own resources, originally as a test bed for particular hardware developments that they'd achieved to do with storing information on cathode ray tubes. The same principle as an old television, but they were using it as a store for binary digits. But you need to build a full-scale computer to demonstrate that that's a useful thing to do. So that's how they got into this. Various other people at national level saw that it would be useful to build computers, and so they sponsored this project. And so Turing was brought in. So he was somebody who had designed a computer, but there already was a computer. And as I say, he was not that interested anymore in that side of things. So when that first computer, the Manchester Mark I, was replaced by the bigger, it was a bigger machine to the same design, the Ferranti Mark I, built in partnership with the Ferranti Electrical Engineering Company. And that was the one for which a standalone building was constructed, which was a big deal in the, this was 1951, and it was really, really difficult to get permission to build anything in that period, particularly if it needed steel for its structure. Steel was really, really valuable, but they were allowed to do this. It was essentially, as I say, it was a larger version of the existing machine. Turing made a couple of suggestions that were taken up in the design of that machine, one of which, quite interestingly, was a random number generator. But he didn't have anything to do with designing hardware, designing computers again. His role was very specifically on the instructions that would go into the machine, so what eventually became known as software, although there wasn't a word for it at the time. It was kind of, it's the stuff that Turing does. And later on, people say, aha, he was a software specialist. And documentation. So he wrote the manual, which was famously, this was something that he was specialised in, but not especially good at by later standards. The manual had mistakes in it. And right. The standing joke was that you would train yourself by going through the manual, working out what was wrong with it, and by the time that you fixed it all, you'd understood the machine. His approaches were famously, he came up with approaches that worked for him, and he was very good at working the way he worked. Not many other people were. He had quite an unusual brain, as we know, and so other people came along and found different ways of programming the machine later on, but he was the he was kind of the early person on the software and the documentation side.
But it was also during his time at Manchester that Turing began to study the concept of artificial intelligence, most famously coming up with the Turing test. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yes, the Turing test is, it's a brilliant idea because he's often seen as being a very, very abstract thinker, but he wasn't. He was very practical in some ways when he wanted to be. And what he did with the Turing test is he said, so a question that people are asking is, will machines ever be able to think? And that's a pretty stupid question, because they define thinking as being a thing that only humans can do. They come up with completely human-centered definitions of thinking, and then they say, no, a machine can't think because a machine's not like a human, which might be a valid opinion, but it's not useful, it's not advancing anything. So he said, I'm going to take that question away and replace it with a practical test. Which is, so you've got a human who is in conversation with another human and with a machine, but there's a screen between them, or there's some sort of arrangement whereby the human can't see which is which. And Turing said, if the term thinking means anything at all that a human wouldn't be able to do, then this is my test. If the one human can't tell the other human apart from the machine, in some given set of circumstances, then you've got to allow that the machine can meaningfully think, okay? Or that some form of machine intelligence is possible. And Turing was optimistic that machines would be passing his test by the end of the 20th century. This made him very, very unusual among people who thought seriously about computers, certainly in Britain at that time. The engineers in particular hated the idea that a computer was an electronic brain, because it's not an accurate description of the machines they were building. They were just very fast but fairly simple calculating machines. And the engineer said, we don't want people thinking about brains because they'll think computers will cause unemployment. They'll put people out of work, or they will take over the world. Remember these science fiction visions? They go a long, long way back. People were writing about these ideas in books in the early 20th century and even a bit beforehand. So the engineer...
Certainly a fear that hasn't gone away either today in 2020.
No, not at all. And so they said, we don't want all this brain talk. It's not a brain. It's a tool. It's just like a slide rule or a mechanical calculating device, except it runs on electronics and it's really, really fast. And Turing said, you know, I'm not sure that's quite right. I think possibly these machines, okay, they may not be like human brains, but they will probably be able to think because you can teach them and they'll be able to teach themselves.
Mm-hmm. So even though computer science didn't exist at the time, it's fair to say that Turing had a fairly significant impact on it as a discipline.
Oh, yes, definitely. This has been the question of how important he was is very hotly disputed, partly because Turing's reputation went on an incredibly strange journey. At the time he died, so 1954, he was by no means a famous person. Mathematical logicians and people heavily involved with computers, which wasn't that many people in 1954, knew who he was. Okay, he was a known name. He was not the most famous known name, and nobody outside that field was likely to have heard of him. Whereas now, of course, he's one of the most famous scientific figures in the world. And that happened for a whole combination of reasons. Part of it was... So one of the things he's best known for, of course, is the code-breaking work at Bletchley Park. That was absolutely top secret, not only through the war, but for about another 30 years, which is extraordinary. Secrets don't usually last that long. And also, of course, his sexual identity. It's a lot easier to talk openly about being gay, having physical sexual relations as a man with another man, now certainly, than it was in those times. And the fact that the reappearance of Turing's reputation from the Bletchley Park stuff roughly coincided with the growth of the gay liberation movement in this country, and particularly the work of Andrew Hodges, who is a gay liberationist and also a mathematician, who wrote that big biography of Alan Turing that came out in the early 80s. That kind of pushed his reputation into general understanding for non-experts. But among experts, which I think is more who you are asking about, again, it's very hotly disputed. Some people think that Turing essentially invented the field of computer science because he wrote that in the 1930s. So probably the thing that he was best known for in his lifetime, he wrote a very abstract paper called On Computable Numbers, which is really not easy to follow. And it solves an important problem in the philosophy of mathematics, which I don't intend to get into here. But some people say from that you can trace the development of all computer science theory. Other people say there is no evidence that the people who came up with the concepts for the first working computers and who then built those computers knew about Turing's work in particular. And the engineers in particular, and above all the Manchester engineers, people like Tom Kilburn, who was the head of the Department of Computer Science for many years, often said, I didn't know about Turing's work when I did this. It was just a process of common sense. And you have to be quite careful because some of those claims are not true. It later on turns out that people who said they had not known about Turing had in fact met Turing, in some cases even been taught by Turing. But on the other hand, there is certainly a lot more to the development of computer science than the computable numbers paper. I mean, it's computing. It's a very big, complicated field with a lot of people making contributions over a very long period of time. There were particular people. If there are any specialists who are interested in this, there's a researcher called Edgar Daylight, a historian who's written about this. There were particular people in the early computer science community in the 50s and 60s in the United States who went back to Turing's stuff and said, yes, this is the stuff that more than anything reflects our values. And those are the people who really first pushed Turing's name in the computing community. That's why there's been an A.M. Turing Award in the American ACM, which is the biggest professional society for a very, very long time. So he did have defenders in the field pretty early on, but it's a bit of a complicated jigsaw. What I will say is that if you focus on Turing all the way through the early story of the development of computer science, you don't get the whole story, but you get a very interesting version of events.
Definitely. You touched upon this before, but it was not many years after arriving in Manchester, and when he'd switched disciplines again, this time to mathematical biology, that Turing was convicted of indecency. A conviction he was posthumously pardoned for, but not until 2013. How did this conviction and the subsequent punishment affect his work?
We don't know. It is very difficult to tell. There's a popular stereotype that this shattered and destroyed his life, and that he was not able to work. That's certainly going way too far. We do know that in terms of his formal status at the University of Manchester, he was not affected by the conviction and punishment. That's certainly something that could have happened in those times, but he had some quite influential defenders, particularly, again, Max Newman, his old friend and mentor. The story goes that the vice-chancellor of the time, JSB Stopford, who the Stopford Building is named after today, asked Newman, you know, what do I do about this guy? And Newman said, nothing. It's not a problem. It's not going to affect anything. He's not going to do anything problematic for the university. Just let him carry on. And Stopford was quite happy to do that. Turing, he was put on this. It was a very unusual punishment. This experimental course of hormone treatments that was supposed to curb his libido and stop him being a homosexual, which it clearly didn't do. It had all sorts of other consequences. Apparently, he grew gynecomastic tissue, so he grew breasts like those of a woman up to a point. It probably didn't do his state of mind any good. It may not have done him that much harm on top of the harm that he'd already faced from learning the hard way that the world was going to treat him like this, and also losing his security clearance, which was something that routinely happened to people who were suspected of homosexuality because they were seen as a blackmail risk. And so losing security clearance meant that he couldn't work on interesting problems to do with cryptography and things to do with national security. So In that period, those last couple of years of his life, he sometimes, perhaps often, seemed to be quite downcast. But it was always difficult to tell with Turing. He had a very complicated and unusual mind, as I say. Certainly, he stopped coming into the university very much, kept working on various projects in his own home out at Wilmslow. But that was that doesn't necessarily signify anything. You know, that was Turing. He would engage very strongly when he wanted to, but not when he didn't.
Well, today, Alan Turing is a true icon of Manchester, and the city's certainly proud to claim him as one of its own, even though he only actually lived here and worked here for less than a decade. Why do you think Turing continues to loom so large in Manchester's heritage?
The late Tony Wilson, who was very proud of Manchester's computing heritage, got it spectacularly wrong from time to time. But he made an interesting observation. This is one of the great Tony Wilson quotations. "This is Manchester. We do things differently here." And whatever else you say about Turing, he did things differently in all walks of his life. He was not only a gay man, he was somebody who was open about it in ways that were extremely unusual at the time, but which resonated with the gay liberation movement from the 70s onwards, and with the kind of vision that grew up around the village of a normal culture of gay life. I think he would be flabbergasted but quite impressed at the direction Manchester's taken in that respect. He was also very unusual as a thinker about computers. As I say, his brain ideas were totally out of line with what the engineers thought at the time. They were also out of line with later artificial intelligence thinking. Some of the big AI pioneers would say Turing was not an AI guy. He was he drew attention to the field, but he didn't think the way that we think. And his kind of vision of linking different fields together. So, I mean, the stuff that he was doing at the end of his life, so he was using ideas borrowed from physical chemistry to try to explain the formation of shape in animal and plant life using a computer. I was about to say for its time, it's a spectacularly ambitious project, but basically for any period, you know, he was more interdisciplinary than most people tend to be. And Manchester has kind of needed unusual heroes. You know, it's got sporting heroes, musical heroes. Going back into the 19th century, it's got a lot of industrial heroes. It's actually had fewer scientific heroes than you might imagine. There was quite a succession of them, but they were mostly in chemistry and atomic physics. With a couple of exceptions. So Turing is quite unusual even in terms of Manchester's scientific heritage. So he was he's been a very popular addition to the list.
Yeah, definitely. Today we have the Alan Turing Law, which is intended to exonerate other men convicted of indecency offences at a time when homosexuality was illegal. So because of this, Alan Turing is an important figure for Manchester, as you touched upon, and particularly around Manchester Pride in August, when a candlelit vigil takes place around the Alan Turing statue at Sackville Street Gardens. And then, of course, he's also the founder of modern computing, and he saved countless lives cracking the Enigma. So with such a huge legacy, and it's interesting that you mentioned that actually when he died, he wasn't that well known, but today he obviously has this huge legacy. What do you think Turing is celebrated the most for now?
Well, you mentioned the Sackville Street Garden statue, and if you go and look at that statue, you will see that it has a plaque, and the wording of the plaque, which I'm just going to check, because I can do that, of course, because I've got a computer. The exact wording on the plaque is, "Father of computer science, mathematician, logician, wartime codebreaker, victim of prejudice. And if you ask what he's best remembered for, everybody who knows about Turing knows that he was something to do with computers. Most people don't know what. The stories that resonate most with people are the final two of those, I think. Wartime Codebreaker and Victim of Prejudice. Now, the wartime code breaking, of course, that's not a Manchester story. The Victim of Prejudice, that very much is a Manchester and Wilmslow story. And it's one of the things that we have to carry, that, you know, it's where Turing did his last work, some of his most interesting work, but it's also the place where that work was brought to a very sad end. But I think Manchester is the kind of place that's relatively good at dealing with complicated legacies, and so I'm kind of pleased. Well, okay, let me be honest. I'm pleased that we got that one to deal with rather than Cambridge.
For sure, yeah. Do you think that Turing is part of the reason students choose to study maths and computer science in Manchester today?
Now, in the past, up to about 10 years ago, or maybe even 5 years ago, I would have very confidently said actually no. Because the computer science department historically tried to keep Turing out of the picture, which might sound very surprising, but it was dominated by a tradition of people who tend to the electrical engineering side of computing and the hardware-focused side of computing, people who are the intellectual descendants of Tom Kilburn, who really didn't get on very well with Turing at all. And Manchester, again, Manchester being different in most things, its computer science department has had quite a hardware-focused tradition, which sets it apart from a lot of computer science in the UK. So it's been very good at designing chips and all that side of the business. That's not very Turing-y. But, of course, nobody can really ignore Turing's reputation these days, and that rift has healed, as far as I know. And they're relatively keen to bring Turing's perspectives back into the picture. And the mathematicians, of course, now we have the Alan Turing Building, which is not a computer science building. Turing, of course, wasn't in the Department of Computer Science because he didn't live long enough for it to exist. So he was officially in the maths department, so he's one of theirs. And the Alan Turing Building is the main building for maths and also astronomy. And there was some discussion about this, and there was some concern about naming it after Turing because he really had no background in astronomy apart from having a telescope when he was a kid. But the astronomer said, "What are you talking about? It's fine to name it after Turing. You know, Turing is a good name." And I would, I'm a historian, I don't teach or I don't recruit students in those areas, but I would imagine if you ask them about it, they would say, "Oh yeah, Alan Turing, Manchester, yeah, he was here."
Mm. And finally, if you had to choose one, what is your favourite fact about Turing?
There are so many, there are the ones that everybody loves. There are a lot of Bletchley Park stories, and they mostly make Turing out to be extremely eccentric. And I would question that. You know, a lot of them, you know, there's the story that he chained his mug to a radiator to stop it getting stolen. And you think, is that particular? I mean, it's not what most people do, but you can't say that it's not practical. So the best one of those, Turing suffered quite badly from hay fever, as many people do. And because he suffered from hay fever, he took to wearing a gas mask. Now, a gas mask is not designed to protect you from hay fever. It's designed to protect you from poisonous gases designed to kill you. So it is a heavy-duty piece of kit. And people would say to him, you know, why are you wearing this horrible clumsy thing, you know, in the summer, and it can't be very comfortable. And he said, you know, on balance to me, it's worth it. And we are at the moment, we're as we record this, we're in the middle of an epic national debate about mask wearing. And Choring is somebody who said, well, look at the practicalities of the situation, work out what you've got to do. Doesn't matter if there are other people telling you to do something different. You need to do the thing that works.
I certainly didn't know that, Choring, an early adopter of the mask. That's brilliant.
So, I mean, maybe don't everybody get a Second World War gas mask because they are not the ideal tool for the task in hand, but bear the overall.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for talking to me today, James. That's been brilliant.